pieces come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times, somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
Welcome to On the Wing Podcast, fueled by Purina Pro Plan. We are coming at you with Rooster Road Trip Episode 4. Very unique conversation. Speaking right from the get-go, the unique conversation starts with the setting. We are at the intersection of a piece of plots, two WMAs, and what's the fourth corner here? I guess that's a WMA too.
Yeah. Yep. I guess there's some private up that way.
But that's a little ways away. Yep. So we're sitting in a prairie with cattail sloughs, and we found three truck birds. They're very close to the trucks, which is where we're parked for the conclusion of Rooster Road Trip, the final day in Grand Forks. And the voice you heard, Dr. Susan Feligi, from the University of North Dakota, professor of wildlife biology?
Biology or wildlife ecology, either one.
And a member of our National Board of Directors for Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, and a stone-cold killer we learned out today, which we will get into. Before we get into that, I want to thank our Rooster Road Trip partners tagging along with us for the duration of this trip through North Dakota. Browning Firearms, which Susan might have one in the future. We'll touch on that too. Federal Ammunition, Orvis Hunting Apparel and Dog Products, Rufflin Kennels, Garmin, Irish Setter Boots, Sound Gear Hearing Protection, and Yeti Coolers. Thank you so much to our eight Rooster Road Trip partners making this trip possible. Also thank you to Purina Pro Plan, the official dog food partner of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, and the presenting sponsor of On the Wing Podcast, my pups Esky, Gitchy, and Winter all eat Purina Pro Plan, not just because Purina supports the wildlife habitat conservation mission of our organization, which is extremely important to me, but also because Purina is a team of the world's best scientists and nutritionists behind their dog food. In fact, Purina Pro Plan Sport was created for hardworking bird dogs like yours and mine. For increased endurance, joint support, and muscle tone, it all starts with Purina Pro Plan Sport. Learn more at ProPlansport.com. All right, here we go. Susan, let's start. Andrew, I'll introduce you to the conversation too.
Don't worry, you didn't get rid of me yet. I'm still here.
let's tell listeners who maybe are popping into this one, Rooster Road Trip. Give us the overview of the concept, just a short soundbite so people are up to speed.
So Rooster Road Trip, this is our 15th year of traveling across the country. This year specifically, we've traveled across North Dakota, in which we hunt nothing but publicly accessible land for upland birds. When this first started, it was an opportunity for us to kind of prove critics on social media wrong, that everyone was saying there aren't birds out there, and there were. And if you put in a little effort and time, you too can go find them, not only find birds, but discover these magical, amazing landscapes and learn to appreciate what is one of the most endangered ecosystems in the world. So what started off as more of a, oh yeah, watch us prove you wrong, has developed into something pretty special and something I look forward to every year. So North Dakota, when I decided to stay just in North Dakota, part of me's like, is that enough of a road trip? And then quickly I remembered that North Dakota is pretty unique, pretty special, and there's a great variety of upland landscapes within this border alone. And some of that uniqueness I'm looking forward to hearing Susan speak about today.
And we're definitely going to listen to, because Susan's got a lot to say about how special this area is. I'm curious, when you think back to the 15 years, In the reaction to the audience from the audience about Rooster Road Trip versus then versus now, what sticks out to you?
I don't know if anything sticks out, but it's been pretty fun knowing that people have watched not only us as people mature and gray out and get older, but also the reach and the impact of our organization. Mm. Where we were 15 years ago is vastly different than where we are now in mm-hmm. a very positive way, but there's still that underlying urge and just that realization that we have to do more. So I receive comments from people every year being like, oh, where are you going this year? Like, you know, how was it? Like, I look forward to this every year. And I think part of that is just because it's so relatable. Mm-hmm. You know, historically I've had a knucklehead dog and, you know, it's, mm-hmm. if I can get out there and do it, anybody can. And I think there is some folks that maybe want to say, oh, how'd they do up there? Maybe we should consider that. That's the reality of it. And that's why we try not to hotspot stuff too badly. But more or less, I just think it's relatable and it's authentic and it's not overproduced. And it's also, it's not as real time as it used to be. We're not posting the day of like our hunts, but you know, when you're listening to this, well, we were just out here a few weeks earlier. Mm-hmm. So I think that's pretty cool too.
We were talking before we hit record with Susan about the genesis of Rooster Road Trip, as you just articulated. And I think about sitting in a, there was a chapter volunteer in Norton, Kansas, who let us sleep in his, like, VRBO before VRBO to save money for the organization. And, you know, that was kind of where we ended up on that first year. And I remember laying up at night just thinking about all the negative comments we were getting on Facebook from people taking us to task for hunting on the company dime. And not, you know, those folks not realizing that this eventually generates, you know, with these 8 sponsors, almost $100,000 in sponsor revenue, $300 to $400 in membership. The evolution of this, now it's so expected. It's, there's so much demand for it. Like the people's perspective, and I know you're looking at me like, Bob, you get it. You're softy, which is true.
It got way
underneath my skin and really bothered me that we were doing this. You know, yes, we were hunting, but we were working very hard to create content, 5 states in 5 days, and getting taken to task a bit. And now that has turned so dramatically, and it's the world we live in today too. People expect content on social media, and this. They want to see the proof of the organization's mission through video, through podcasts, through photos. And that's what Rooster Road Trip does better than just about anything we produce. So people now connect the dots, and there's virtually no trolling related to Rooster Road Trip anymore. But, man, I had sleepless nights in the early days.
I was probably too young to realize the pressure you were on or under at that time. So I guess ignorance is bliss there, and I was just able to sleep through it.
Yes. Well, I didn't, but here we are. All right. I've teased a number of times Dr. Feligi. Do you want me to call you Dr.
Just
Susan?
Just call me Susan.
Thank you. That's easier.
Just call me Susan.
Like I know you enough to just say Susan.
I don't even expect my students to call me Dr. Feligi. Just call me Susan.
Susan. Tell our listeners that you've been on the podcast before, but it's been 2-ish years probably.
Maybe about that. I think the last one was the one right before Carson was born. It was the Mother's Day feature.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. That's right.
So maybe a year and a half ago.
Yeah. For folks that, so you've been on 2 podcasts because you were with the Women on the Wing sub-series and then on with me when you joined the board of directors. But for folks who haven't listened to those two and maybe don't know your name at this point, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got here.
Yeah, so I'm a professor, as you mentioned, here at the University of North Dakota, so Grand Forks, North Dakota. We're almost to Minnesota here where we're at, the very eastern edge of North Dakota. I've been here now, this is about my 14th year in North Dakota, and as I shared earlier today, I've wanted to be in North Dakota, South Dakota, or Montana ever since I was a child. I grew up mostly duck hunting, and dove hunting, a little bit of deer hunting, and the occasional upland bird here and there. But the ducks really were the thing that was a draw in the Prairie Pothole region, and I got a chance to band my first duck when I was 13 years old, and in my journal it says, I'm going to go be a wildlife ecologist someday, you know.
What was the duck? What species? Do you remember?
Most of them were mallards that day.
Okay.
So, I think we banded probably a couple hundred actually that day. It was a pretty cool spot. I ended up later being hired to work there.
As a 13-year-old?
No.
What do you like to
18.
Do? Okay.
You have to be 18 to drive their vehicles. So once I got to about 18.
So didn't you say 13?
Well, I was 13 when I did the first duck I banded.
Okay.
I volunteered.
Gotcha.
So, and I did that. My dad would take me frequently to volunteer and band ducks and geese. And
gotcha.
And then when I turned 18, I mean, I had a pre-trained person that had been coming for years. so I got a chance to actually do it as a technician.
I thought we had the Doogie Howser of wildlife biologists at our hands.
Yeah, maybe. I've done a lot of things young, but yeah. And so I realized I really wanted to pursue wildlife and ended up going to college. I went to Penn State, but I went to a smaller campus, not the big main one, up in Erie. And I pursued a biology degree and a math minor and constantly kept working for the Pennsylvania Game Commission and volunteering and doing whatever I could that was outdoorsy. And then I knew that a graduate degree was probably something that would really help me and open up different options for me. And so I was at one point really exploring how to bring together my passions originally of a lot of math and quantitative tools with the biology piece of it and the wildlife ecology. So I explored different options in that, and then I found an opportunity to go work on Bob White's in Georgia, where the project, I started as a master's student, but the project was big. It was looking at nest predators, and it was a large project, and there was the opportunity to just roll right into a PhD. And so I instead converted from a master's student to a PhD student and pursued that for about 4.5 years, and then got a chance to teach a little bit at the University of Georgia. Right before the whole teaching thing, I was like, I'm not going academia. No way. That is just not the arena I wanted to be in. But the whole time I was on that educational journey, a lot of other people had different ideas and were constantly grooming me for academia.
Why did you resist wanting to be a professor?
I didn't see myself as a professor. I didn't think that was the arena for me, and I wasn't sure if I could have an impact. I wanted to really impact conservation, and to me, much like my students feel, that patch on your shoulder or whatever you're wearing, that was where I was at. That's where you had the dirt between your toes. That was what I saw as the impact. And then I had a chance to teach students. At any given moment, I was probably about 5 minutes ahead of them on what I was sharing and trying to convey to them. But I realized there was an opportunity there, and I kind of liked the classroom. I liked watching what happened with the students, and I said, maybe I better reconsider this. And so I had this chance to teach for a year, and then I started applying for faculty positions, and it turned out all that grooming that they were doing for me set me up really nicely, and there was an opportunity here in North Dakota. And they took a chance on a fairly young professor, or PhD, and offered me an assistant professor tenure track job, so the whole big kid job. And so Chris and I moved from Georgia to come to one of my dream landings, which is in North Dakota. And the cool part is my PhD advisor, John Carroll, actually got his PhD right here at the University of North Dakota, and I am in my academic grandfather's line. So I'm replacing essentially who would have trained my PhD advisor.
Wow.
So kind of a fun full circle how it all comes together.
And you shared with me in the field a little bit ago about your perspective changing. You know, you said you wanted dirt underneath your fingernails. You wanted to impact the environment kind of firsthand. And then your perspective changed when you started teaching students. Explain that a little bit more for our listeners.
Yeah, so I also realized that there's a lot of opportunities for some autonomy within being a professor, opportunities to pursue the things you're most interested in. And I started to realize there's a lot of different ways you can be a professor and a lot of ways you can have impact. Some of those are in the classroom. So I get to take the students out, and my classes are known for the field trips we do. They're known for the hands-on experiences. I take my students, and we all have the dirt between our toes, like Alda Leopold would talk about. And then I did research projects. And I would think that most of my grad students will tell you, you know, I'm not just the armchair quarterback from the office. You know, I make sure, especially as we get projects out there, I'm out there helping them. I'm in the field. And that translates to me getting to see and learn new things, but also make sure we got our eyes on what's important and doing it right. There's a lot of things that you can plan out. I mean, you can think about hunting trips. You know, you look at sometimes this best laid plans, and then you realize you get there and you're like, well, let's toss that idea out and toss that one. Science is the same way. You know, you have to sometimes adapt and improvise and work with the logistics of it. And I got to see, hey, I get to be here right beside them. No 2 days is the same. No two projects are the same. No two students are the same. And I got to look and do projects that, you know, I work hand in hand with North Dakota Game and Fish. And we're doing things that sometimes will impact regulations. They impact where we're going to put management, how animals respond to specific management actions. Now that's starting to say, hey, you are having a conservation impact. And then I watch, and we talked a lot about this at the tailgate, watch what my students do. And, you know, I need to keep better records on some of this, but some of them are also highly mobile, I guess. But you go and you look and you see where they're at. You know, the pheasant biologist here in the state of North Dakota, he was my grad student. You know, some of your employees, including our videographer.
Yeah, Jordan, about 20 feet away, was a student.
One of my undergrads.
Yesterday's featured guest, Seth Owens, one of your students.
One of them, yeah. And so you start looking at that and you're going, wow, you know, impact might not be what I originally thought. Impact comes in a lot of different ways. And that shift I started to see, but as I've matured through the academic rankings, I see it more and more.
The other thing, you know, I mentioned you're on the National Board of Directors of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. You're very much connected with Ducks Unlimited and do projects, like you said, North Dakota Game Fish. Your, for lack of a better phrase, your star is on the rise, or has been on the rise, in the wildlife community, where the kids that are thinking about going to college connect you, your name, with potential opportunities to advance their careers, and that's drawing students to the University of North Dakota, isn't it?
Yeah, because we've had some of our work featured in Ducks Unlimited magazines. I was on an IMAX, in an IMAX film, Wings Over Water, which I found out about 12 hours before I ended up on that. You know,
we let you know like 48 hours before Rooster Road Trip was coming.
So, you know, you do get some different opportunities for marketing for the university out of that. But, you know, you look at what my students are doing and the opportunities and partnerships we have, that's how you get stuff done. And, you know, that's where it shows up. And the students who frequently want to come to this major, they're looking in those magazines, they're looking at that kind of content, and they're going, I could do this just like I did back when I was making this choice. I could go be that biologist. I could go have that impact. And here's a place that you can do it.
Tell us about the kind of the prototypical college student in your class today. Maybe that's a tough question, but like, give us some demographics. Where are they from? Do they hunt? Are they male? Are they female? Like, who's coming to take a class?
Well, over the past 14 years, that's really changed, and I think it's become more diverse in terms of what we have in our students. When I first got here, about 20% of them were females. The rest were males. The bulk of them all hunted and fished. Now I would say we probably have about 50 to 60% that clearly are hunters. If you put in fishing, it's a little bit higher than that. But they are all pretty much an interest in the outdoors. We are about 50% male-female in terms of our student composition there. And that's a growing demographic. We see increased women as a whole in wildlife biology. So we have a nice split, in that.
Cool.
And the states, you know, when I got here, it was North Dakota and Minnesota, students. We still are very heavy in North Dakota and Minnesota in particular, but I've got students from, I have a brand new one who is literally grew up 30 minutes from where I did, back in Pennsylvania. So I now have two students in our program from Pennsylvania, one from each side of the state, students from Nebraska, one of them from Georgia most recently. He had moved around, but we were talking, and he'd even worked with someone I knew about, you know, in South Georgia that I just came across when I was hunting and got to know from that perspective. And so they're from all over now. Mm. And it's really neat to see. And that, you know, you look at Jordan, came from Hawaii,
yeah,
you know, in our program.
Was that a head scratcher for you?
Yes. Yes.
It was a head scratcher for us.
Oh, yeah. Knowing our weather,
yeah,
and our winters, I kind of looked at him and said, which wrong turn did you make here? Because this is, you know, and I hope you have a lot of layers, because this is a little bit chillier than where you're from. But no, it's been really cool to see. And it has brought a lot of diversity and excitement to the program. And a chance to expose people from all over to this cool landscape that you brought up. Mm-hmm. North Dakota is amazing. From east to west, the variety we have here. You go from right here where we're sitting, the tall grass prairie, a historic area where we're in a Red River Valley. It was once a glacial lake.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It has 1 inch of elevational change every mile while you're sitting here in the valley. Although we might have, you know, some of these ditches kind of throw that perception off. But it's very flat, right? And then you start going west and you get into the mixed grass. And so a little bit lower, not quite so high grasses. You get rolling plains. You start getting potholes and the classic duck factory characteristics. And then you keep going west. And as you get towards the Missouri River there and go west of the Missouri River, you get into that short grass prairie. And then the rugged badlands that is absolutely gorgeous in its own right as well. And so in one state, you can see so much from, you know, our flat landing side here where, well, you know, you can see forever, you know, the dog runs away, you can watch for miles, you'll see it, you know, to the ruggedness of western North Dakota, where, and you can chase sharptails from one end of it to the other, which,
yeah,
is pretty cool. And increasingly now we're seeing roosters even from one end to the other of it, so.
And that makes you smile.
It does.
Well, we're going to transition to talking about the day and the spot and why you selected and the specialness of this particular area of the state. I want to shout out to Onyx, proud supporter of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. And you can find a link in the show notes that'll take you to a special Onyx hunt page. Use the code PFQF there and you get 20% off your subscription to Onyx, and a portion of that purchase will go back to Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's wildlife habitat mission. So thank you very much to Onyx for supporting the organization, this podcast, and public lands everywhere. All right. We called you up more than 48 hours ago, about a week ago, and we said, Andrew said, we want to kind of close Rooster Road Trip in the Grand Forks area. What was your first thought?
Wow, you want to come here? At first, but I was like, this is great. And I also, though, felt like Andrew was a tiny bit hesitant. Let's just be honest there. He was like,
I was.
Do I really want to end it in Grand Forks?
I was searching for an honest, truthful answer. You know, one of your former students gave me a little bit of advice that hinted at, you know, that area of the state could actually be a little bit of a sleeper for you, and it has a cool story. It's like, okay, that sounds great, but I'm not just going to jump right in without doing a little vetting.
Yeah, so this area, it's not the spot you look for. If you're coming to North Dakota and you're thinking about, you know, bag limits of roosters or lots of sharp tails, you're classically going west, you know, and that's what you think about. But we have this little cool nugget of grassland that exists here in Grand Forks County and awesomely in my backyard.
Hmm.
You know, when you look at it, it's about 6 miles wide and runs pretty much from the south to the north end of the county. And it's an area that, as I mentioned earlier, is historically very salty. It's a saline prairie. And as a result, it hasn't seen much of the plow. And it's been protected from that. And so it's a cool, cool grassland. And it's an area that has been recognized for its uniqueness. If you talk about tall grass prairie, there's, depending on where you look at the estimates, there's maybe 1-4% of it existing and remaining on the landscape. And to find really intact stuff, true tall grass prairie, it's really hard to do. And while not all of what we saw today is intact, perfect prairie, we do have some really cool areas that are in this county. And it's a spot that some people back in the 60s said, hey, this is special. Let's start protecting it. And it was really centered around an upland bird of a lot of interest, which was the prairie chicken. And we got to hang out on the Prairie Chicken WMA, which was named after that effort.
So that was the spot that in your mind you're like, there's the place I want to take them to tell the story of the prairie chicken and the sharp tail and the habitat and the uniqueness. So that's where we are. We're at the Prairie Chicken WMA.
That's right.
In kind of north of Grand Forks. And this, explain what you think this looked like when prairie chickens were released, which was back in the 90s, right?
Yeah. So it might be worth thinking back even a little farther than that.
Okay.
So there's some discrepancies about the extent of prairie chickens in the state of North Dakota. But generally, they probably weren't super abundant here until settlers started to come through. And they came with the settlers. And at one point, prairie chickens actually were found all across the state of North Dakota. As that settlement occurred and small grains and things like that happened, there was some pretty cool things that allowed for prairie chickens to expand to the west. And then as different habitat conversions happened, they sort of pulled back. We saw some bigger ag and other things. And by the 1960s, they were pretty restricted to the Red River Valley, with two main landholdings being the Cheyenne grassland to the south and the Grand Forks Prairie here. And so
during that same time, what are sharptail populations doing in North Dakota?
So very, very abundant to the west of us, but relatively low, and not many documented. And when you hear about a lot of the prairie chickens, there were very few sharptails here. They were here, but in lower numbers, much lower numbers. The prairie chickens were the dominant grouse here.
Okay.
And so, chickens were doing well for a while, and then their numbers really started to go down, and a lot of that was some loss of habitat. And that's what led us to sort of the 1960s when people started protecting them. But it was a struggle. They take a lot of land and take a lot of grass we need to have. And so what a group of creative people said was, let's first build it. Let's work on protecting some grass. A guy named Ed Bry got a group together, and it involved partners from groups like Fish and Wildlife Service and North Dakota Game and Fish as some of the key players. And you guys got to hunt a little bit of Kelly Slough area. That whole complex was basically obtained and thought with a lot of the effort associated with this prairie chicken effort. So land started to be acquired, and that led to Prairie Chicken WMA, the Kelly Slough Complex, these waterfowl production areas, and ultimately a nice little piece of grass that also coupled with CRP. And so at one point, there was probably about 45,000 acres of grass right here in Grand Forks County. And when that was there, folks said, now's the time. Let's go ahead and bring chickens in.
Okay.
And what that looked like, I think, was a bit different than now. And from what I've heard, I know that everyone's feeling a little bit of the cattails we marched through today.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was a lot less cattails.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I think was not as dominant is probably the amount of Russian olive that we see on the landscape.
And brome, maybe, too?
Probably a lot less brome grass. Yeah, yeah. Probably a lot more of the native plant community.
So do you remember the year, 1990?
92 is when they did the start of the releases.
Okay.
And so between 92 and 98, they released almost 400 prairie chickens in this area. And we are not far from one of those release sites. We actually walked over there to right where that was at and had a chance to stand there and think about what that might have been.
In the peak, how many birds do you estimate were here in this area at the peak of the prairie chicken? Not going back to the settler times.
More recent times.
Yeah.
Yep. So the work that was done, they did a great job. They put some radio collars on the birds. They tracked a lot of movement, home range type things. But there was a lot of intensive survey work, which is what brought me to this world, is the survey work. And as you looked at it, immediately there was responses here. Lots of birds. It went up, and in the peak in about, I think it was 2004, they estimated from their counts 330 booming males right here in Grand Forks County.
300 booming males. So how many can you extrapolate females out of that?
I'm going to have at least double that probably to get at your females. So okay. Depending on those sex ratios, 600 to 700 chickens.
Wow.
In this county, in this nice little cool grassland. It was protected, and largely, I mean, the chicken was the reason to really think about it. That's what was the story to help people protect this grass.
The WPAs were even created around prairie chicken conservation?
They were a part of that story. Now, certainly waterfowl was a big deal, too, in that, and that's a lot more the Fish and Wildlife Service prerogative in that arena, but there was an opportunity to work collaboratively and recognize that if we have these, because I mean the uplands are important to ducks too, right? We've got a lot of upland nesting birds, that nesting ducks, and so those uplands as well as those wetlands and that that whole network within this ecosystem was important. And so, yeah, the Fish and Wildlife Service was a major player in securing land and putting it under permanent protection.
So, 2004, 600 to 700 birds. That's not that long ago. I mean, you know, I'm looking at Andrew. You know, it wasn't, 20 years ago for you. You were in high school?
It's my senior year of high school.
It's not that long ago.
I know what I was doing in my senior year of high school. I don't want to talk about it now, but, like, yeah, I can remember it.
Right? So it doesn't feel like, you know, no, it's where did the chickens go?
Yeah.
Where did the chickens go? Well, as we walked through today, you saw, we've been in the 90s, since about the 90s, in a fairly wet period, which has been great for ducks and everything. But here in this area, it's also led to a lot of opportunities for some of these wetlands and some cattail encroachment to happen. And so with it being wet, a lot of cattails have expanded. Trees do well when it's wet and need
Russian
a lot
olives.
More water. And so, yep, so the Russian olives, and there was a lot of planting of Russian olives as a tree that would, and shrub that would help hold soils, would make good windbreaks. And a few Russian olives are not a problem, but Russian olives can quickly, much like smooth brome and some of these others, quickly become a problem. And you may have even seen some of these areas when you go around Kelly's Slough. They've done a really good job, but then like some of the neighboring areas, a lot of people don't understand that, you know, it's not supposed to have all these shrubs here and don't know about controlling them. You know, they want something to hold their soil down and make windbreaks. They want something to protect their houses and farmsteads. I mean, even my area around me is, you know, has a lot of Russian olives that we've been slowly trying to, you know, whittle back on. And so, yeah, they've been a challenge. So I think those are things that have changed. We've also lost CRP acres. And that's been one that you can actually look and I can share with you. You know, you look at the graphs. CRP goes down, even sharptail, because the sharptail actually peaked with the chickens for a while there. We saw increases in sharptails, increases in chickens. Everybody was kind of going a little bit gangbusters there in the early 2000s. And then as those CRP acres were lost, that was probably the most pivotal. We lost grass, and then we lost some quality.
Yeah, you lost the CRP grass on private lands that abutted some of this permanent protection. So you lost all that connectivity. And what you explained to me out in the field, you know, the difference, you know, so sharptails are surging maybe a little bit strong, but they're doing pretty well. But they're also incredibly tolerant comparative to the chicken. It's funny, like the pheasant is probably the most tolerant of the bunch. Sharptails, a little more tolerant than the prairie chicken, and the prairie chicken just needs wide open spaces like the Dixie Chicks would say, right?
Absolutely. Wide open spaces and a lot of that wide open space.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where I think, you know, that original 45,000 acres was probably kind of the bare minimum, and losing that was big. And, yeah, when you look at the different preferences here, the sharptails will tolerate, especially the Russian olive, a little better, and you can even winter-wise find them around those. But there's a point. There's a tipping point. And I think that's a concern we need to keep our eyes on with this prairie, and that's what a group of us are trying to do is say, you know, a little bit of a tree cover is one thing, but it can be too much and it can be too much fast. And that's not just for these upland birds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a lot of grassland birds, which is one of the most declining bird groups, is grassland songbirds. This affects them too,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the quality of this habitat affects the pollinators. And those pollinators are important for agriculture too. These things are all linked. And so we have to remember, you know, we might have talked about the chicken being the front page of the story, but what that's done for a lot of other critters is pretty amazing too.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit more about this Grand Forks Prairie
Partners. Yeah, so the Grand Forks Prairie Partners kind of has a long history that dated back and overlapped quite a bit with the time when some of these restoration efforts were happening with the prairie chickens. And it's a group of super excited, both community members, but also folks that are NGOs, you know, Pheasants Forever, Audubon, Ducks Unlimited, and then it's the state and federal partners. We're looking at U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, North Dakota Game and Fish, USDA NRCS groups, the soil conservation districts here in the state as well, but in our county specifically, are all coming together and saying, okay, we got this cool piece of property. And that's really what kind of got it started, was a bunch of interested folks saying, this is cool, this is special, this is unique. They got the areas, like you saw on the sign over there, important bird areas.
Mm-hmm.
There was a recognition of what the value was, and tried to garner a lot of more support to both protect it, but hopefully eventually expand it in some ways, and certainly keep the quality up. And so there's been different folks through the years. My predecessor, Crawford, his wife, it was Rich Crawford, his wife Glinda actually was one of the major people at the beginning of this all, passionate about the prairie, absolutely passionate. And she was one of the first folks with the Grand Forks Prairie Partners. And then through the years, there's been others. The most recent to me is Dave Lambeth, who is an avid birder and has quite possibly the best bird record you're going to find here. He's been responsible for doing our Christmas bird counts, and I'll tell you, he's been a huge spokesperson for this grasslands.
Hmm.
You know, and he's a retired biochemist from UND, but his ornithology work has been, and grassland protection has been probably the thing that really rises to the top for us. And Dave, I met him very early on here, and he taught me a lot about the prairie. He taught me a lot about the prairie chickens. He would lead some of my field trips when I didn't know what I was doing about where to go, you know, because much like you, I'm in Grand Forks here. What is there to offer? What is there to show the students? And he would come out with us and say, let me show you.
Hmm.
Let me show you how special it is.
All right. So we talked to you about going on a hunt, and you pick prairie chicken WMA, and then you quickly say, oh, and by the way, make sure you don't shoot a prairie chicken. And
there was such a pucker factor. Are you kidding me?
Right. So
there's like how many prairie chickens left right now? Like,
yeah, rough number. How many prairie chickens?
We counted about 9 males. So, you know, we probably don't have many 20, 30 birds maybe in the county. But we hope we counted most all the males in our efforts. But there's not many.
Give or take 20 prairie chickens in this area left. Yeah. And this is the first year that this area is open to sharptails, because the state's basically said there's not much we can do for prairie chickens. But sharptail numbers are in a good spot,
yep.
And people, and there's public land here, go hunt them.
Yep, they wanted to make sure there was access for the public, and at this point, you know, there was an opportunity here for a lot of growing opportunities here on, in this particular block. So Grand Forks County, south of Highway 2, was open and has continued to be open. And it did have prairie chickens as well. But this was the core area where all the restoration and efforts were. And so when the numbers declined, they had shut down all the sharptail hunting here. And this is the first year they opened it up. And the pucker factor is there for everyone. You know, the pressure's super high for me, because I'm like, I'm supposed to recognize these, and you know, you want to make sure you got in, and you can tell, but it still doesn't, in the heat of the moment, not bring a little tension to
Yeah, like you think about what would happen if you did accidentally at least shoot one. and like explaining it to like not only a CEO, but in the world we work, like your boss and then a board member. Mm. And you're like, so let me get this straight. You were on the Prairie Chicken WMA. And you shot a prairie chicken. You were surprised
Which
to find
illegal,
a prairie chicken? Right. One of the only places that you'll still find them? You're surprised to run into those? And you, okay.
Yeah. So let me add one other piece to this. And Susan's like, we're going to go there. We really can't. We got to make sure that it has a sharp tail, not a square tail. Like, okay. And then she says, oh, there might be hybrids. So they mate.
They do. Which is pretty interesting. So my whole world about these birds and even the grassland I came to appreciate much more when Jesse Kohler, who you got to meet and hunt with earlier in the week, called me up and says, Susan, we need somebody to take over the survey blocks here where you've got prairie chickens and some sharp tails right there in Grand Forks County. Think you can handle that? Any interest? And I was like, absolutely. And it was a great opportunity to train students. And I was, yeah, okay. So we get out here and we start surveying, and became evident very quickly some of the birds were doing this real strange thing. And as we came to describe it, teenage boy kind of thing. They squawked a little funny. They didn't quite have the dance moves. And you start going, well, is that chicken? Is that a sharp tail? And you know, you've looked here. Most of that survey is a roadside survey. You're looking out across this area. You know, you're trying to watch Alexo, and, you know, and all of a sudden you're like, is that bird, like, I know I've been up really early. Am I seeing things? And it takes sometimes getting close to them to know that they're actually not chickens or not sharp tails, but a cross. And so, yes, we have these now mixed things that are hybrids, which adds to the complexity because they'll get up and look a little bit funny. Well, on the wing, it's very hard to tell. Hmm. Very hard to tell. So, yes, it's fun.
Those are legal, yes?
Yeah, because there's no way to tell. Yeah. And most of them, if you were to shoot it, they're going to be pretty light underneath. Mm-hmm. You're going to see that white that would prompt you to say, oh, that's a sharp tail. But then when you get it in hand, you're going to look and go, wait a minute. There's some things about this bird that don't look right. You know, some things about its tail that might look somewhere between that beautiful fan that you get with a prairie chicken to the, you know, real sharp pointed central tail feathers of a sharp tail.
So let me add one final layer to this. We pull up to this spot where we parked and got out at, well, let's say 7:40. Sun's just coming up. And you point down this two track and say, 12 pheasants flushed there the other day I was here. So instantly I'm thinking, so I gotta watch out for hens too. Yep. Right? You got chickens, pheasants, sharp tails, and hybrids. And you better be careful. Let's go hunt.
It's a place where you gotta be on your A game on some things.
Yeah.
And you gotta watch what you're doing.
And you were on your A game. So let's take us through our first walk here. Where'd we go? Why'd you take us where you went?
So I wanted to walk you across some of the land that had been protected with the prairie chicken in mind. So we went on to this prairie chicken WMA. We had to kind of approach it so we weren't walking into the sun from a side that was a little bit less ideal, but we were going to do it. And because this is an open area, I had never hunted it before, you know, that we just opened up. So I was like, let's go learn something.
Mm-hmm.
If you know anything about me, I went to college and I never left. You know, it's because I love to learn. And I have surveyed it in the spring, but that doesn't necessarily mean you know a whole lot about it from this time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So I had never walked this piece where we were at with a gun in hand or this time of the year with this purpose.
Because if you had walked it before, I would have thought you were mad at me.
If I had walked it before, I would have been trying to see whether or not your cardiac and all your legs were up to snuff, because it is a chunk with a lot of cattails. But that's not unusual for here.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, there's a lot of cattails. And it's a cool place because, you know, you think about western North Dakota or central North Dakota. You think about rolling grass and sea of grass. And, yeah, there's wetlands. There's potholes. you don't think about the fact that you got to go through hundreds of yards of cattails, but then you open up to this really cool, like, patch of grass, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened? We saw a couple sharp tails, mm-hmm. right? And everybody, I know I could feel the tension when the first birds come up of, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you want to know what that is. But we walked that, and we walked towards, ultimately, where they released the birds. And we walked towards sort of the area where in the spring we see a lot of shuffling. So Lex here in this part of the North Dakota are a little different in that we're very wet in the spring. And with this high water table, we have a lot of overland flooding. So Lex are actually highly mobile. Hmm. I have to try to make sure I actually am counting a Lex and saying that's the same birds because they shift around. And so we kind of walked through one of the areas where there's three different spots there that sometimes I see the Lex being. As we kind of progressed over to where the release area was that they had released birds back in the 90s. And we did find a few sharp tails, but it wasn't without looking through the cattails first and marching through them.
We marched through some cattails, but we came, like you say, right to that where the sign was, and something happened that almost never happens, which is you see a sharp tail coming from a section away, and it falls right out of the lands, literally lands, 100 yards from us?
It was close.
Just drops right in front of us. Like, well, here we go.
Here we go. And that we did. And I also learned that you can get right up on them. And it was clearly a beautiful sharp tail because it was right there for me. And as I worked the safety, I clearly didn't work the safety because I pulled up and there was a click. And that bird was very safe after that. But
well, I missed too. I was on your right, and I had an opportunity, and I clearly knew it was a shark. I just flat missed, which we had all the warning. We knew. We watched that bird land. We had a dog on point where it landed, and that bird is going to breed next season.
That's right. That's right.
So we make our way through a very long cattail march, and we'll pass the baton to Andrew because Andrew enters the picture now.
Well, we kept drifting the wrong direction.
We did that too.
But these blocks are so big, and it's just, again, not what I expected out of this area of North Dakota. So after we kept on reorienting ourselves and trying to figure out, okay, how do we start getting back to the truck, we plowed through a pretty healthy stand of cattails again, which is the theme of this year, which is I did not expect that. But we came out towards another island of grass.
Mm-hmm.
And just randomly, a single popped up, and it was crossing left to right. And I had a great vantage point in terms of where I was able to see the underbelly and a little bit of its side. And I was able to just instantly, like, I didn't even think. So the first Sharpies we saw, a pair got up,
mm-hmm.
and everyone let them go. And then as we kept walking, Nate and I looked at each other, and he's like, we probably could have shot. I'm like, yeah, we could have, but we needed to warm up a little bit. Like, let's get that sight picture in our mind again. So by the time this bird got up, it was a no-doubter, and I just had to act fast. Having listened to Susan explain the history of this environment, this landscape, and what more needs to be done, I just – like as a kind of like a producer role with the road trip, all this, mm-hmm. I just really wanted like a bird for us to have in hand to kind of go full circle on it. And luckily we were able to drop it, and some of the tension left the room a little bit because it wasn't
weird.
A prairie chicken, and we got one in the bag, and it was awesome.
There was tension. Just it happens every darn day on this road trip where it's like, and this year, more than most, like you alluded to in last episode, we've not had our A game from a shooting perspective on display this year, which we're marketing guys.
And it happens.
You know, it happens. Sometimes you have it and sometimes you don't. But we'll pass the microphone back to the marksman in the group, markswoman in the group. So we got back to the trucks, sharp tail in hand, pressure's off. Our story complete, And you were jonesing to chase some roosters.
Yeah, well, I mean, you don't see roosters around here very often. This past year, our surveys showed me more roosters than I've been used to seeing. And so I had actually walked a little bit of this area on the other side, kind of away from where we started, and had seen a few roosters before and was like, maybe we could go chase those, you know? And so I had managed a week ago to get one rooster here in Grand Forks County, and I'm pretty excited about that. But I was like, I think there's a few more. Let's try for that. And so that's what led us down a trail of me also redeeming myself on using the safety and being able to pull the trigger and everything. But yeah, maybe before we even did that, one of the things that we also saw was those sharp tails got up. And one of the things I have seen is early in the morning, you know, you start getting mid to late morning, a lot of times you'll see the birds in some of these Russian olives for sharp tails. And you'll see them along kind of this road where we parked a little bit, kind of mocking you a little bit. Like, here I am.
I mean, literally in the trees.
Yep. Yeah. And they're watching you. And so I was like, well, I don't know that we're going to chase another sharp tail with some success here because they're sitting here laughing at us while we're over here. So that definitely takes us to let's go chase a rooster, which was pretty exciting because, like I said, they've not been historically many around here.
So we're walking the two track, cattails on both sides. You're on top and got people fanned out on both sides of the two track. What'd you see?
Well, let me back up. Dogs starting to do their birdie thing, and you could feel it. And I'd mentioned, you know, we'll probably end up pushing them and then start seeing them pop out as we get to some of these corners with them. And that's exactly where the first one made its appearance. Dog gets birdie, you feel everybody's excitement, and up came a rooster, and down went a rooster.
So rooster number one on the edge. It was basically, it played out exactly how you said it would, right? I mean, you said, we're going to walk towards the popple tree on the left. There's a, just past the Russian olive, there's a cornfield that's not great at the corner, but there's corner, and that's exactly where that first rooster got up.
Exactly where he was.
You were ready. You made a great shot. And the Browning Sidori was like, oh, it's kind of a sweet little gun.
Yep. The gun and I, we found our stride, and it was pretty nice. So right now, if my husband's listening to this, he's cringing slightly, going, uh-oh. At the same token, he's kind of like, oh, this is good. you know, there's a couple ends to that. But, yeah, he'll be excited to hear how it worked for me.
All right. So... on we go along this plots two-track cornfield.
Yep.
And dogs get birdie again.
Yep. Dogs get birdie again. And
out up, pops a hen.
Yep. Up pops a hen. And then up pops our rooster. And then, and that one came up, plopped right down. And then up came another hen, if I remember.
Yep.
On that. And so... Yep, that was, and it was just kind of past where I had expected to see the birds, but I think all our activity at the one spot, they were running a little bit away from us, and we finally caught up with them.
You caught up with them. So number two. We walked to the end, and as I recall, there wasn't anything else towards the end. But funny, we turn around, and there was one hiding.
Yeah, well, I kind of heard a lot of chatter of everyone, well, let's head back to the trucks, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, don't forget there could still be a truck bird here as we come back, you know? And I think at least one person might have even already unloaded, and I, you know? And I'm coming along, and of course, there was a dog on point, and then all of a sudden, there was a rooster right there, and conveniently, really nice going away for me shot there, and that one went down too.
And you had your North Dakota Daily Limit of roosters.
I did.
And you got a good meal ahead.
I got a great meal ahead. Yeah. I got a great meal, and I'm excited. My little girl's going to love that in particular. She's all excited when we eat pheasant. That's a big thing.
Yeah.
She got to eat some a couple different times when she was little, and I don't think anyone realized how much she could eat, but when pheasant was presented in front of her, whew, that kid could put it away. So she'll be excited.
So do you think you'll get a Satori now?
I don't know. There'll be some conversations, some interesting dinner time conversations.
It's a pretty special place. I mean, when you think about, you know, we haven't moved the trucks all day. Mm-mm. And, you know, roosters and hens, sharp tails, in theory, prairie chickens, some hybrids, songbirds. You know, thank you for taking us to this spot. It's awfully beautiful.
It's a special place, and it's a special place I think a lot of people don't even realize is here. In fact, I don't even think a lot of people that live in Grand Forks recognize what's in their backyard. Hmm. You know, one of the most endangered ecosystems, and there's a nice chunk of it, and there's a lot of cool stuff hiding in it.
If folks want to learn about the Grand Forks Prairie Partners, how do they learn more about it?
If you Google it, there's actually a website about the Grand Forks Prairie Partners. And then, you know, working with any of us that are me at UND, but also, you know, Fish and Wildlife Service, Pheasants Forever, Audubon, NRCS with USDA there, all of us have a partnership there. So if you asked any questions to almost any of the main players, people can get you headed the right way. But if you go on there, the website, the folks way back when had actually developed even a birding tour that if you want to go see the grasslands, there's some cool spots where you can go, and especially in the spring, and walk and see all kinds of cool birds mm-hmm. on a trail through this grassland. So,
you know, we talk about this with the North American Grasslands Act, Conservation Act all the time. It's like grasslands like this, or the prairies in your own backyard, the sagebrush in the west, or the glades in the south. They're so easy to take for granted because we just think of them as our backyards, and they're disappearing, and that's what that Grasslands Act is supposed to, you know, in theory, going to be able to protect. And it's places like this that are so special, but you drive by them and you don't necessarily notice them.
I had lived here about 7 or 8 years before I actually really, really understood it.
Yeah.
And it was... I keep bringing back the prairie chicken. It was the prairie chicken that brought me to that. It wasn't that I didn't drive through it. Wasn't that there wasn't stuff I saw. I could see grass. You know, I could see birds. But it was those prairie chicken surveys in 2019 that changed it for me. Absolutely changed it. Because I realized the value of what we had. And I got to see it from a different perspective where you have sharp tails booming. Or sharp tails dancing and prairie chickens booming and the beautiful call of a meadowlark, you know, as the sun rises. And I got to walk those, you know, in those early mornings, and with a real different eye, I was looking at them, you know, and I was realizing how incredibly unique they were, but I was also realizing how we got to hurry because those chickens that I had just done a whole lot of studying about, so I was equipped to go survey them, they were really, really, really in trouble.
Yeah.
And that's what brought me to how much and how important this was. And I'm a wildlife biologist, and I didn't even quite get my head around it until I saw it from the prairie chicken's eyes.
Mm. Well, that just underscores something we touched on in a previous episode. It's like you can't be complacent with what you have, even if you're having a good year. So if you think about the Sharpies that are here now, or pheasants mm-hmm. at large, like you have to be actively engaged and actively working to improve what you have so that there is a future. Like, complacency is not an option.
I think that's a great point. I mean, Susan and I were talking in the field. You know, the prairie chickens have largely disappeared here. Sharptails are in good condition now, but it doesn't take a biologist to walk through this and see the cattails, the invasive cattails that are here overtaking this prairie, and sharptails are going to get squeezed out in a matter of a decade.
Yeah, if we don't start doing some things between the Russian olives and that, you know, you guys talk a lot about the Green Glacier. Mm-hmm. You know, we have our own little thing happening here relative to those Russian olives that are taking over and then the cattails. If we don't start solving some of those habitat quality things, we might have a grassland here, but it's not really going to be a grassland anymore, mm-hmm. you know? And so we have to take action, and we have to do it now, and we have to, you know, defend the core here of what we have that's something special. And that's what this group of really engaged folks that, you know, even include the local birding club. That's what they're enthusiastic to do, and that's what we're working to get money on the ground to do, is start cutting back some of these Russian olives, and then start considering how we chip away at some of the challenges with the cattails. Mm-hmm. And how do we keep these blocks of grass as nice as we can keep them? And then eventually maybe we can expand them too, but I think we need to start by being good stewards of what we have. Mm-hmm. And then you can work from there.
Yeah, it's a pretty special place. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Yeah, it's a spot that has become near and dear to me.
Yeah, rightfully so. Yeah. Andrew, Rooster Road Trip, membership, special offer.
Well, everybody head to roosterroadtrip.org. Not only can you listen to our previous podcast episodes and view all the videos of all this action that have been released up to this point, but more importantly, for being honest, you can join or renew your membership with Pheasants Forever. As a thank you, we'll provide you a Browning Bird and Buck knife set, and you'll automatically be entered to win a Browning Satori 825. So just like you just heard us talking about, don't be complacent. Don't take this for granted. Please do your part. Make sure your membership's active, and if it's not or you need to renew, well, take advantage of a special thank you that we have for you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Also to our Rooster Road Trip partners, Browning Firearms, Federal Ammunition, Orvis Hunting Apparel and Dog Products, Ruffling Kennels, Garmin, Irish Setter Boots, Sound Gear Hearing Protection, and Yeti Coolers. Thank you to all eight of our Rooster Road Trip partners for riding shotgun with us across the great state of North Dakota. As we conclude, we reach the end of the road for Rooster Road Trip 2024. We will be back to recap Rooster Road Trip 2024 once we get home.
A little tailgate talk. Put a bow on it.
Talk about our favorite items of gear and favorite memories.
Who fell in a hole the hardest?
Hey, I left my boot there.
Susan's a contender, for sure.
I don't know if anyone got a good picture of me standing there ripping at my boot.
Thank you, Susan, for joining us. Thank you also. You know, we didn't talk a lot about your role on the board of directors, but thank you for being a committed volunteer on our board of directors, helping steward the vision of the organization and leading us to see beautiful places like this and making our organization as robust as possible to help conserve properties like this.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. This is great, and thanks for letting me share the fact that we've got such an amazing little gem here that I want to see it continue on for many generations, you know, and let people watch those birds jump out, and you have to inspect them carefully. I hope someday there's some other ones that maybe we see chickens again, but for now, what a cool thing. What a cool place.
Yeah, absolutely. What a cool place. For Andrew Vavra, for Dr. Susan Feligi, I'm Bob St. Pierre, thanking you for riding along Rooster Road Trip 2024. We'll come back one more recap episode. In the meantime, always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks for listening, folks.